Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We're very excited about this week's show. Up first is former U.S. Marine Mike Scotti, who has just released his first book called The Blue Cascade, which is about how he had to deal with the disturbing memories and painful emotions he went through when he returned from Iraq and active duty. Up next is Dr. Christopher Vaughn, who gives parents great advice how to help prevent their children from sustaining concussions in contact sports and how to handle the injury if they do. We then round things out with some wonderful spring planting tips from CanadianGardening.com's Tara Nolan.
Capture your need for sound.
Thankfully, for most of us, we have no idea what it's like to go to war and into dangerous combat zones that have you fearing for your life 24/7. However, there are brave people around the world that decide to stand up for their country and make sure it stays a safe and peaceful place to live. One such person is former U.S. Marine Mike Scotti, who is a veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan, and who has just written his first book, The Blue Cascade, about what it's like to try and return to normal after being at war and integrating yourself back into a civilian society that just doesn't understand what armed forces personnel have actually gone through and witnessed during their time in combat. Mike, welcome back to The Kelly Alexander Show.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, Mike, I've been reading your book, and the word that comes to mind is mesmerizing. Can you start off by explaining the title? What is The Blue Cascade?
You know, The Blue Cascade was something I came up with when I tried to kind of visualize what it is that you, kind of the feeling that you feel when you come home from a war, you know, and it's the isolation, the combination of isolation and depression and anger, and which can lead to rage. And it was just kind of like being underneath a waterfall, and it's just almost crushing you and just completely consuming you. And, you know, trying to move, getting behind the waterfall and pushing past through all that stuff, because there really is like a flow to the whole thing.
Now, when I was reading the book, it feels like you definitely don't hold anything back, especially, you know, describing some of the horrors that you saw over there. For example, I know there's an image that you put forth in the book about a little girl who basically, you know, her innards were out for everyone to see, I guess. How difficult was it for you to relive that memory? Was it traumatic for you or therapeutic for you?
Well, I mean, the first time, you know, when you're actually experiencing it, you're in combat, so you kind of have to swallow those feelings down. You can't really react to it emotionally, and you kind of deal with it later. It's almost like putting it in like a filing cabinet in your brain. And the first time really reliving it was making the film, you know, which we were discussing last time I was on, whatever, you know, the film Severe Clear, and actually seeing those images on video, you know, blown up on a screen was, you know, was obviously hard to deal with. And then, you know, really reliving them with, you know, this is all described in the book, was this whole process of making the film. And, you know, so kind of reliving that whole thing real time, you know, while making the film was the most difficult. And then, you know, looking back and writing the book, you know, about making the film and about, you know, all the different parts of the process, I think was kind of putting that chapter to bed. Really, so putting the war memories to bed was kind of making the film, and putting the post-war experience to bed, I think, was writing the book. So now it's finally done.
And was there a conscious decision as to how you were going to write your story, or did you just sort of sit down and let the memories and the experiences flood out?
This book pretty much wrote itself, and, you know, when I sold the outline, you know, you really, with a nonfiction, you write the first two chapters, and then you write a detailed outline for the rest of the book, and that's what your agent then sells for you to the editor. And I really had I had to actually shorten the outline because it was like 60 pages long. And so there was just, I knew exactly what I wanted to say. And I kind of wrote the book by scenes, and the book, I think, kind of reads almost like a scenes from a movie kind of unfolding one after the other. And so I knew exactly which scenes I thought would be compelling and kind of capture the essence of what I was trying to say.
When I was reading the book, you mentioned, and basically almost in the beginning of the book, you mentioned that when you first came back from your tour in Iraq and you were discharged from the Marines, that you wanted to write, you know, the book, I think, kind of right then. Obviously, things didn't work out, which, you know, your readers will figure out as they read the book. But do you think everything sort of happened for a reason in the fact that you didn't write it as soon as you came out of there?
I do, and I think it's a much better book. I mean, you know, what I tried to write when I first got back, you know, ended up kind of being made into the movie Severe Clear, but the book you know, there's a lot of scenes, I call them the flashback scenes, kind of in, you know, in the central part of the book, where a lot of what was written there was taken directly from my notebooks or, you know, some of the stuff that I'd done when I'd first gotten home. But I think this, you know, the book about coming home from war, I think, is a little bit more compelling and unique than just another Iraq war memoir about fighting a war. And I think it's timely, and it's part of the conversation of, you know, of what's going on with a lot of the troops. So I think it's the right time, and absolutely, I'm glad I had waited, because I think it's a better book.
Now, as I was reading the, you know, the pages, I really felt that you conveyed very well how angry you were at civilians and basically life in general when you actually returned to the U.S. Can you explain why that was?
Sure. I mean, it's you're angry at the world. I mean, you're angry because you go from combat and you know, to the civilian world fairly quickly, and it's no one else around you has the shared experience. And you know, the brave act, it's such a unique experience of being in combat, fearing for your life, and kind of the brave acts that your buddies are doing on a daily basis, even if you're back home, your units are, you know, other units or people that you know that are still over there, they almost seem meaningless when you come home, because, you know, the people just don't kind of remember that you're in a war, and it doesn't seem like a wartime world that we're living in. It's kind of like in the background. And so you've, you know, and add to the fact that, you know, for me, the big thing was going over there to defend, you know, my country, the U.S., from, you know, a terrorist attack or weapons of mass destruction or whatever. And you know, having that not be the case, having there be no weapons of mass destruction, and the mission kind of morphing into liberating a people from, you know, a dictator, and then morphing again. I mean, it's just, you know, you become kind of just, you know, disenfranchised with the whole thing. And then your buddies start getting killed, and you start burying people, and it can be very, very difficult to deal with. You know, add to that being young, and I think, you know, a lot of, you know, for males at least, you know, the depression or confusion or whatever can kind of manifest itself as anger and rage.
Something that I found was very interesting as well, especially in the, I guess, the beginning stages of when you were explaining your return to the U.S. and what it felt like to, you know, to be back on home soil, was the fact that you felt that you weren't getting a lot of support from various, I guess, people that would see you in uniform walking down the street. Can you explain that? Because, you know, coming from an outsider's point of view from Canada, I know we're close neighbors, obviously, but, you know, I think we always view the U.S. as very patriotic and very patriotic towards their troops. But I got the sense that's not always the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting when, you know, I think the example I used in the book was out in California. I was stationed in Camp Pendleton, California, which is about halfway between San Diego and L.A. It's actually right on the tip of Orange County, kind of the northern part of San Diego County. And, you know, there's definitely not a big love for the Marines kind of around base. And you know, there's places in Wilmington, North Carolina, you know, Wilmington, South Carolina, by the East Coast Marine Corps base, where there'll be signs that say no Marines allowed and things like that. And it's because, you know, Marines are young and they're trained, you know, for combat. And, you know, when they're out on liberty or stuff, they can kind of get themselves into trouble. But there's definitely a distance. I put that in there to show that there is just a distance between civilians and military. And, you know, when you get out of the military, you become a civilian and you're living the rest of your days in the civilian world. And that's where there can be that kind of like a gap, you know, that isolation. And you add to that the lack of shared experience, and that's where you start to run into some problems.
Joining us on the show is former U.S. Marine Mike Scotti, author of the new book, The Blue Cascade. You can find him on Facebook, The Blue Cascade by Mike Scotti. Make sure to check it out. Also his website, MikeScotti.com. Mike, I wanted to ask you, you know, speaking of the fact that when you returned and you felt that, you know, people didn't understand what you went through because, you know, we obviously were not there like you and your buddies were. Do you think that at that point it didn't matter if anyone really understood you because you were just angry? Like, because I remember reading at one point in the book where your brother's significant other at the time was talking about wanting to send packages over to troops, and you got very angry about that. And I think that was sort of just the straw that broke the camel's back. But do you think even anyone sympathetic, even your parents being sympathetic, really didn't matter at that point because you were just angry?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely become shut down at some point. I think you cross some sort of, you know, invisible emotional line, and to where, you know, you kind of lose even that reason, or you know, nobody can reason with you or your loved ones or whatever. You're just mad, and you're mad at anything that's connected in any way to anything. And, you know, that's where you, at that point, you need to either ask for help or, you know, you need some serious introspection or whatever. And, you know, and that's, you can continue down that road, and it, you know, can end badly. I mean, the suicide rate is pretty high for post-war veterans, so.
And speaking of that, actually, something I also got a sense of when you, you know, were talking about your immediate return and wanting to just sort of get discharged is that you all had to undergo, I guess, like a post-traumatic stress disorder meeting. And it felt like the way you conveyed it was that there wasn't a lot of support in that, even though, you know, the Army or the Marine Corps was doing that for you guys. Do you think it's gotten better? Do you think there is more support for young soldiers coming back and having to deal with the after effects of what they've been through?
There's absolutely more effect, in my opinion, from the military side while you're still on active duty, just because they have to, and you know, they know what they need to do. But where it falls apart is after you get out, and you're kind of in the civilian world, and you're not surrounded by your buddies and those who have had that shared experience. You know, in the U.S., there's the Veterans Administration, and which is a complete mess. There's been a lot of talk about that lately. But, you know, there's also that stigma and of coming forward and saying, maybe I do have something wrong with me, and whether it's a shame, you know, people being ashamed and don't want to come forward, or pride or whatever, or if they're still on active duty, it could have negative repercussions for their career, which is definitely a factor.
Now, something that was eye-opening for me was just how much I didn't realize the emotional roller coaster that, you know, you guys in the armed forces were on, constantly having to be alert while you were over in Iraq and Afghanistan, constantly, you know, seeing, you know, grotesque scenes of death and destruction, and constantly, you know, having these incredibly high feelings of fear and anxiety because you never knew what was coming around the next corner. What was that like to deal with on a daily basis?
While you're there, you know, you're focused on the mission as much as you can be, and you're focused on, you know, outward. You're focused on the enemy and where they might be coming after you, and you're focused on your own unit's vulnerabilities. And also you're focused on, you know, not making mistakes and doing things, you know, with attention to detail and thinking things through. But a lot of times you're doing this without sleep. I mean, I think the longest we ever went was close to like 96, 97, or 98 hours or something like that without sleep. And so, you know, it's just... it's the chaos that is war, and they call it friction. And it's just it's such a foreign concept to anyone who hasn't been through it. But it's also, you know, being hunted by a living, breathing human being who's out there trying to kill you. You know, in that situation, it's almost like the boogeyman is real, and it just goes on for months and months.
Can you explain what you mean when someone officially becomes a veteran of war?
I think it's, you know, there's a scene in the book where I can actually see it happen in somebody, in a captain. I saw it happen kind of in his eyes, because I'd known, because it happened to me just before that. I think becoming a veteran of actual, you know, combat, when you think of war, I think it's a moment when kind of war unmasks itself and all that it is, whether it's a scene of just complete carnage. For me, it was, you know, a field of dead bodies that had just been, you know, raked with 20-millimeter machine gun fire and different types of cannons and things, and they were just mangled corpses and a whole field of them. And, you know, the smoke is burning, so it's every, you know, you're smelling the flesh burning and tires burning, and there's helicopters flying, and you just have this whole experience all at one time, and it kind of, all these sense, you know, all these sensory, you know, things that are out there are just, they just focus themselves, and they just etch themselves on you, and I think that, at that moment, you kind of become a veteran when you realize what war is.
Can you give us maybe a bit of perspective? Because, again, it's fine for us to be over here, you know, reading these stories of about, you know, Marines or soldiers or... you know, even peacekeepers that end up, you know, getting killed in action. What is it like when you actually lose someone from your unit? You know, is it several days of you trying to have to refocus to, you know, put it into perspective? Or is it just you have to shut down immediately and be like, that happened, we got to keep going and we'll grieve later?
You know, it's definitely the second option, because you got to stay focused on the mission. You can't let things fall apart. So you have to grieve later. And like I said before, kind of put things in like an emotional file cabinet. And later is usually after you come home. It could be weeks or months or even years for some of the vets. And it also, I think, depends upon how close the person who fell, you know, was to you personally. Were they, you know, kind of one of your circle of friends? Were they a close buddy, or were they just somebody that you knew kind of in the unit? And, you know, that you know, has a lot to do with it also.
And, you know, when one of your colleagues, you know, falls, and are you guys replaced immediately with someone else? Because I'm wondering if that's even hard to have a new person come in to take that person's place. Like, it almost feels like that might be a bit, you know, causing of aggression.
You know, it depends upon kind of the length of the deployment, how late the deployment is, and kind of manpower in the Marine Corps. You know, early on, there weren't too many combat casualty replacements to go around. So they were pulling people inactive, you know, inactive people that had gotten off of active duty that were in what's called the inactive ready reserves. And it was, you know, sergeants and captains that were thought they were, you know, done with their service, had been called back involuntarily. And that can be interesting also, because a lot of times combat casualty replacements could be somebody who doesn't necessarily want to be there. You know, it's somebody who's done their time, maybe done multiple deployments, gotten out off of active duty, and then been called back from civilian life. And that can have implications also. I'm not saying they won't be professional, but it's just a different, you know, they're new. They're somebody new who's been kind of injected into a situation. So.
And in your experience, do you believe that, you know, most armed forces personnel suffer some type of PTSD when they return to their home countries after seeing stuff like you've seen?
I absolutely do. And I think that, you know, whether they call it post-traumatic stress disorder, where someone's like, you know, highly incapacitated, or just post-traumatic stress, I think it's just a continuum, right? You've got maybe having bad dreams, you know, every once in a while, kind of on one end, on the lighter end, and then, you know, killing yourself on the other end. And I think anything kind of in between there, you know, is basically encompasses the post-war experience. And I've, you know, the official number for the United States is 20% with the study that always gets, you know, kind of talked about. But I've heard numbers as high as 40 or even 50%. But I think that if you're a normal, you know, loving, caring human being with normal range of emotions, and you've been in multiple deployments of sustained combat and seen all that carnage, that you are absolutely affected in some way. It's just how long it affects you for, and kind of to what extent.
And in the book, I remember you speaking to other veterans that you met in other parts of your life, that, you know, were people that you'd never met before, but you'd happen to see them or meet them at your workplace. And I remember in one section of the book, one of these veterans said to you, you have to let it go. Is that, I guess, a different process for everyone, you know, the time frame when they can let it go? And do you think it is, you know, extremely important that you come to that point, that you let it all go?
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, for everyone, people are as different as snowflakes, right? So some people, just as their reactions could be anger versus depression. You know, some people become very quiet and mute. Some people become violent and angry. Some people turn to substances. But I think, you know, moving towards that goal of letting it all go, you know, is very, very important. And if you can actually truly get to that point, you know, it's really is a beautiful thing. I mean, obviously for me, Memorial Day, I always obviously get a bit sad around Memorial Day. You know, and just to, you know, that's the U.S. holiday, whatever, but just a side note to there, some people will say to me, Happy Memorial Day, you know, thinking that it's the same thing as, like, a Veterans Day or whatever, but, you know, it's just odd. It's those things that it's kind of like nails on a chalkboard or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, if you can be at peace with what happened over there and just live your life and live simply and, you know, fall in love and, you know, enjoy every sandwich and, you know, spend time outside and just live simply, I think that's the key to the whole thing.
And do you feel that you have reached that point of letting it all go?
I have. And it took me a movie and a book and about 10 years to get there.
Okay.
But no, I have. And, you know, it's through a combination of talking about these things and being creative about them and putting the bad energy onto the page and with real emotion or into the film. And it's also giving back, whether it's through charity work, through military veterans charities, or just, you know, talking to buddies who, you know, may have lost their way and kind of were where I was, you know, 7-8 years ago, and just talking to them about it, you know.
And can you tell us who you wrote the book for? Was it for you? Was it for your buddies? Was it for, you know, other veterans? Was it for the public to get a sense of, you know, what you really went through?
I wrote the book really for other, you know, for other veterans. I wanted to make it intimate enough and real enough so that other veterans would connect with it. And the reason I did that was because when we released the movie Severe Clear in theaters, you know, I had conversations with a lot of different veterans, and I saw, you know, young men usually between like 24 to 27 who had done their 4 years in the military, gotten out, and then had been home for a while, and it might have been struggling. I saw kind of the darkness in their eyes, and I said, well, if the movie could speak to these young people and help them realize that they're not alone, which is what a lot of them said to me, or help their families realize what they went through, I figured I could even do something even more personal and talk about the inner struggle, you know, the demons of post-war, and really kind of get it out there.
Do you feel it's important?
I also wanted to become a writer, so, oh, you know, that's the way to my career.
Very good, very good. And do you feel that it's important, because I know one of the themes that I was sort of taking away from the book is that, again, and you just sort of mentioned it, the feeling of isolation and being alone, especially because, you know, in your instance, and like you just mentioned, a lot of other people's instances, they leave the military. They're not there with buddies anymore. They're not there in an environment that fosters understanding because you've gone through it. Do you think it's important for, you know, whether it's Marines around the U.S. or other armed forces personnel from whatever country they come from to have some sort of, you know, support group in their own community, even if it's only two or three of them that have been in the military, that they have a time, you know, once a month or whatever, to get together and to just be with each other and understand maybe feelings of anxiety they're having or still, you know, sleepless nights, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the human connection of the whole thing is key, and it's key to the healing. And I didn't have that. I didn't reach out to anyone, and it's not like they're not out there. I just didn't go searching for them, and I was living in New York City. You know, I had friends, but none of them had served in the military. And so, you know, for me, the unit my kind of quasi-support group became the people that were working on the film with me and some of the characters from the book, like Cece and Christian Fraga and the other people from Cirque Productions or whatever. But it's absolutely, you know, important to do that and to, you know, if you can't get together physically, you know, in your geographical area, if you trust your own buddies more, then, I mean, you can talk on the phone or Skype or whatever, but the key is to think about thinking and to be introspective and to have self-awareness and say, you know, maybe I shouldn't get this angry at the person driving slow in front of me, like it's throwing me into a complete rage, you know, or things like that. Maybe something's not right here, and that's the key. And whatever you need to heal yourself, whether it's group support or, you know, painting a picture or writing a short story or going to more formal, you know, help, whatever it takes is what you need to do.
And I wanted to ask you as well, you know, because when I was reading your story, you did sort of explain at certain points that you'd always been interested in the military since you were like a little kid. After what you've been through, do you regret or have feelings of maybe I shouldn't have signed up to be, you know, a Marine, or are you very proud of what you've done and the career path you chose?
No, I'm very proud. I'm very proud of what I did. I love the Marine Corps. I think it's a pure institution. Even, you know, it has its faults, as does any, and obviously it doesn't make its own decisions. It's, you know, the politicians that send us into the war, but the Marine Corps itself is something that is very pure, and it fosters kind of purity of heart and a camaraderie that it's really, really hard to find. And I've been all, you know, I've been through business, I've been through Wall Street, I've been, you know, running different companies, I've been in charities, I've just done a lot of different things, and it's hard to find something the equivalent of that. And I am very proud of the way that we fought and what we did over there, you know, the reasons were what they were. And, you know, we have no, that took me years to come to terms with that. I had no say in what the war was or why, you know, what it was fought for supposedly. But, you know, I can only talk about what we did, you know, while our lives are on the line, and that I'm very, very proud of.
And I'm glad you explained that part, Mike, about the fact that, you know, you had a job to do and it wasn't you making the decisions, because I think something that is important for people to understand, you know, especially if they take out aggression on troop personnel like yourself, you were just doing what you were told. It's not that you and your buddies, you know, are all these testosterone-filled guys that just want to go rip people's heads off.
That's an important kind of distinction. And, you know, there's obviously some of that because it's young and you're young, and that's where, you know, the discipline and the training comes in. But it's also, you know, before we would cross the line of departure into Iraq and cross into battle, they basically told us, you know, that the Iraqi people will have no, you know, better friend if they, you know, if they choose to not fight. You know, even if somebody was shooting at you 5 minutes before, they throw their hands up, they'll have no better friend. You give them food, you give them protection, you give them whatever they need. But if they choose to fight, they'll have no worse enemy, and you have to crush them. And that's the essence of what the Marine Corps is. So.
And Mike, where can people get a copy of this book?
This book is available, you know, at every Barnes & Noble in the country. There's going to be a big Father's Day push for it in the United States. They can get it on Amazon. They can get it on BarnesandNoble.com. They can get it on Nook, Kindle, you know, audio download off the website. And you can go on Facebook. It's The Blue Cascade by Mike Scott. It's a Facebook page. There's, you know, pretty much anywhere books are sold, you'll be able to get this thing.
And what
it's in hardcover. So.
Okay. And is this ever going to be made into a movie, do you feel? And what's next for you? Because I know you always have something on the go.
Not sure whether they're going to sell the movie rights or not. It's who knows? I mean, it depends. You know, that's out of my hands. I would love to see that, obviously. But, you know, there's other people working behind the scenes on that.
Okay.
As far as, you know, what I have next, I'm actually putting to bed for a while kind of the Iraq-Afghanistan world, and I'm actually taking a left turn, and I'm going to be writing a love story in the genre of more of like a Nicholas Sparks type book, based around very beautiful themes like saying the things that you need to say to your loved ones while you still can. So
fantastic. Well, Mike,
write some lighthearted stuff, you know.
Good for you. Take a little bit of break, and I just want to thank you again and thank you for sharing your story, and I really think a lot of people are going to enjoy reading this book and taking away all the positives from it.
Well, I appreciate that very much, and I appreciate you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure.
Excellent. That is former U.S. Marine and author of the new book, The Blue Cascade, Mike Scotti. Again, make sure to check him out on Facebook, The Blue Cascade by Mike Scotti, and also his website, MikeScotti.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
The suicide of former NFL player Junior Seau is raising new questions about a possible link between concussions and long-term mental health. Junior suffered numerous head injuries during his career, and his death is giving renewed attention to the risk organized sports may pose to children. Someone who can shed some light on the issue is Dr. Christopher Vaughn, a pediatric neuropsychologist at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. Dr. Vaughn is also an assistant professor in the departments of psychiatry and behavioral sciences and pediatrics at the George Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Vaughn, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly.
Now, Dr. Vaughn, Junior Seau's suicide, I believe, really sent shockwaves around the world. From what I understand, no one saw this coming, you know, from him. I think he was able to, if he did have these issues, keep them sort of to himself. And he's not the only former NFLer to take his life from apparent mental issues that would seem, you know, linked to this very rough and tumble career that he had.
Yeah, I certainly don't know if we really understand if this suicide, obviously a very tragic event for him and for his family, if it's really linked to his, you know, any potential concussion history or if it was due to other factors.
Now, from what we understand, you know, Junior suffered multiple head injuries during his career. Do you believe that there's a link between, you know, head injuries and what can happen mentally over time with maybe depression and other forms of cognitive issues?
Certainly, we're starting to see some evidence that for some individuals, multiple concussions or multiple blows to the head over the course of a career may make them vulnerable for some long-term problems. But the research is still really in its infancy, and there's a lot that we don't understand for related to what kind of injuries and how many and what sort of the risk factors would be for some people to have these long-term issues and for many others not to have long-term issues.
Now, I've read a lot of articles, you know, about athletes who play contact sports. And oftentimes, you know, in some of these articles, family members will mention that their loved one, you know, has mood swings or can get maybe verbally abusive or even physically violent. Do you believe that these may be symptoms, you know, from head injuries getting worse over time?
It certainly is possible that for some people, yes, but there are a large number of athletes from playing high school sports or playing collegiate sports or even at the professional level without the effects from the same number of hits to the head. So what we really need to try to understand is who are these individuals who may be more vulnerable? Why is it possibly happening to some people and not others, and what really are those factors coming together that may set off some long-term issues?
Joining us on the show is Dr. Christopher Vaughn, a pediatric neuropsychologist at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. You can check him out, childrensnational.org/score. All of these head injuries with fully grown athletes, you know, very troubling. But if you start to consider that these types of injuries are happening in children and teenagers who are playing, you know, organized contact sports, you know, at a very young age, it seems even scarier.
And we certainly know a lot more about this injury as it pertains to children and as it pertains to the more common and immediate effects of concussions. And so based on what we do know, there's a lot of good management and guidance to prevent, you know, potentially long-term issues, but certainly immediate issues.
And is there a lot of research going on now into kids and head injuries, you know, from sports, Dr. Vaughn? And I guess what types of symptoms can kids experience following a concussion? Is it similar to what an adult would experience?
In some ways it is. Certainly the research has grown exponentially in the last number of years, and fortunately that's also driven more research towards looking at the effects of the injury in children. You know, with a developing brain, we have a lot more concern over how a brain injury is going to affect that development and a child's functioning. Certainly the child's job is to learn in school and to practice new information that's being acquired through learning. And so when you've got an injury that affects somebody's ability to learn, somebody's ability to take tests or participate in the classroom, there's a lot of immediate risks associated with that.
Are you concerned at all, Dr. Vaughn, about the sports culture? I know, you know, in the States and other places, it's you know, there's lots of pressure put on kids to perform and to not complain and, you know, to be a big man or whatever. So if their bell is rung, they sort of get back in there. What do you think about, you know, that pressure to not really mention if they are, you know, in pain or did suffer a head injury?
We know that the biggest risk is when somebody has a concussion, if they go out and continue to play and get hit multiple times while they're still suffering from that initial injury. And that's true both in men's sports, but certainly in women's sports as well. And there's a lot of pressure in girls' athletics to be tough and to continue to push through symptoms. So the emphasis that is being seen at the professional level to remove athletes from play, to have an appropriate evaluation and a proper medical clearance is something that we really need to stress at the youth leagues as well, because while there are many more youth athletes than there are professional athletes, there are far fewer resources to be able to provide appropriate guidance and management. And there's certainly things that we're working on to help address that.
What do you suggest to parents, you know, who have a child in contact sports, such as football?
The biggest way to prevent the risk and the consequences of this injury, quite honestly, are to become educated about it, to know what to look for if your child's on the field and takes a hit or is checked into the boards or whatever it may be, and knowing what signs and symptoms to look for, to ask about, that would suggest that there's been a change in the way that the brain's functioning. If there's a suspected injury, then the protocol becomes fairly clear, and we know that we need to get that athlete off the ice, off the field, and seen by a medical professional who can evaluate whether or not there has been a concussion and certainly whether or not that injury is resolved and when it's safe to return.
And speaking again of children, because I'm assuming, again, I'm not a doctor, but I'm assuming, you know, their brain's not fully developed until whatever age. So is it really imperative that parents and coaches realize that if there is, you know, any type of scare or injury, that really it is imperative for their life to take care of them and make sure that, you know, this is being handled properly?
I think it is absolutely critical that with a developing brain, we don't yet fully understand the consequences, and there certainly may be some more risks to a developing brain than there are to an older adult brain. But, you know, for any athlete at any level, if we think that there's an injury, we need to take precautions to protect that person from being re-injured and injured multiple times in a short time frame, because that certainly sets us up for the risks that we think for longer term injuries may be there if somebody has had multiple concussions in a short time frame.
What do you say to parents, Dr. Vaughn, who have had a child that has had a head injury? How do they proceed and monitor and really monitor their child, you know, their child's recovery? And then I'm assuming their implementation back into sports, because, you know, kids don't want to not play their sports.
The first step is, of course, making sure that they're out of harm's way. So whether it's participating in sports or activities on the playground or outside where there could be an additional fall or collision, absolutely kids and families need to avoid that during the recovery period. We also need to really emphasize managing schoolwork, because we know that physical activity can worsen symptoms and slow down recovery, but many people don't realize that cognitive activity, the type of learning and concentrating that goes on every day in the school setting, can really prolong and slow down recovery as well.
And what types of recovery should be happening for a child that has suffered a head injury? Is it rest? Is it lots of sleep? Like, what should parents be, you know, trying to make sure their children is doing?
Rest and sleep are very important. The brain will do a lot of healing on its own, and we just need to help facilitate that by not putting somebody in a setting where they're overactive physically or mentally. You know, reducing stress, remaining hydrated, eating a healthy and balanced diet, you know, is all important to facilitate the brain's healing.
Joining us on the show this week is Dr. Christopher Vaughn, a pediatric neuropsychologist at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. You can check him out, childrensnational.org/score. Do you think current safety equipment like helmets are actually really safe enough for kids?
It depends on what type of safety you're asking about, because we know that helmets were designed initially to really prevent skull fractures, and helmets do an outstanding job of preventing skull fractures. They were never initially intended to prevent concussion, And so really the way that the head and brain moves from being hit, helmets do very little to reduce the risk of injury, of concussive injury.
And I've always wanted to ask, you know, someone who would know this, and I'm assuming you would be that person, when it
okay.
comes to, you know, that jarring jolt that you may get with a concussion, is it really the head being hit, or is it like the neck and the quick movement? Like, where does the concussion really sort of happen?
The injury happens from the brain being shaken, and concussion actually comes from the Latin word concussus, which means to shake violently. So whether or not that's a direct blow to the head hitting a stationary object, or even the body moving quickly and stopping, such as in a car accident, any force that's strong enough that causes that brain movement can cause an injury.
So does extra neck protection at all, like, because I mean, I watch, you know, car racing, and I know that they have that extra protective gear now that they wear, almost like this extra helmet that basically goes over their shoulders. And I'm forgetting the name of the apparatus, but I know that it's supposed to help them if they are in a car crash, that it doesn't jerk them violently. Is that, you know, some type of technology that might be able to be implemented for football players or hockey players that could maybe help the jarring of the neck?
I think that might be one pathway to look into. Again, I mean, certainly if we can prevent the head from moving quickly, that would potentially reduce injury. We also talk about neck strength as being a possible mechanism to protect against injury. And certainly, particularly at the youth level, teaching athletes to use good techniques and good you know, the sportsmanship in terms of how they may hit or collide with another player may ultimately reduce the number of concussions.
Lately, I've been reading a lot of articles about soccer and, you know, injuries that are happening there, especially, I guess, with boys and girls that are doing headers. What's your position on that?
The simple answer is we don't yet entirely know. There's been mixed results looking at whether or not headers cause concussions. You know, certainly in some circumstances they might, but in many circumstances, when they're done properly, they really don't cause concussions, because oftentimes the individual is braced, is sort of tightening their neck muscles, is targeting their head at the ball, so that when that force and impact happens, there's not a lot of head movement. If anything, the ball is the object that's moving. So generally speaking, headers that are done properly with good technique are not going to cause an injury. Now, what does happen a lot, of course, is that somebody may misjudge their header and the ball may ricochet in a direction that they weren't expecting it to, or two people are going for a header at the same time, and so the collision occurs between players. So there's a number of circumstances where headers may set up somebody for a risk of injury, but generally speaking, a properly implemented header is not going to cause a concussion.
Okay, I'm glad you cleared that up, because again, it just seems like lately there's this plethora of, you know, articles coming out and people being concerned, so I'm glad to get an official stance on that. And Dr. Vaughn, I really wanted to ask you about something that you're involved in with regards to a smartphone app for parents to use for their kids. Can you tell us what it's called and tell us what it does?
Absolutely. We've got a concussion recognition and response app that's available through iPhone and the Droid markets. And this really is designed to be used by parents, coaches, other non-medical providers as a way to screen and look for a suspected concussion. It's not a tool that's available to diagnose or to treat an injury, but rather we want parents and coaches to know what to look for. You know, we guide them on the app. We guide them through, was there a force taken? Was there a hit to the head or the body? And then these are the signs that you should look for. These are the sorts of things where somebody may be moving in a clumsy manner, or they may be confused about the play or what's going on around them. Or you want to ask specifically, do you have a headache? Do you feel dizzy? Are you, you know, having a hard time concentrating on the game? And the parent or coach can really work through all the different signs and symptoms. And then if an injury is suspected, there's guidance given in terms of following up with appropriate medical care. You know, these are the kind of considerations you may need to have in terms of returning to school. You know, these are the warning signs that would tell us, let's get somebody to the emergency department because there may be a more severe injury.
And where is this app available? Is it on different platforms, Dr. Vaughn?
Both iPhone and also the Droid marketplace.
Okay, fantastic. So on the iTunes store and all that, you can grab it?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And concussion recognition and response.
Perfect. And I wanted to ask you as well, you know, you were just talking about how this app can help parents and coaches like on the field. Do you think, you know, for some of these sporting events, I guess specifically if there's tournaments going on, whether it's a soccer tournament or a football, you know, game and, you know, something where it's a bit higher level, I guess, or there's more importance put on it. Do you really think it's necessary maybe that technicians, medical technicians are on hand? Because, for example, I'm in martial arts and I know that at any time I'm at a karate competition, it's mandatory that we have an ambulance on site, whether it's for a head injury or, you know, someone got cracked in the face.
I think so. Absolutely. I mean, having medical practitioners available at sporting events is very important. Unfortunately, the injuries occur at both of those high level competitive activities and at the youth practice, you know, so whether or not there's medical practitioners available, you know, certainly having parents and others who know enough to follow a fairly straightforward protocol of removing an athlete from play is also very important and will probably be just as beneficial.
And do the symptoms that happen coming off of a head injury, do they happen, you know, very quickly? Like, is it imperative to get the help right away for these children or even, you know, full-grown athletes?
I think it is helpful to be seen soon after the injury. If the injury has been sustained, there's typically a change in the way the brain's functioning. And so as a result of that, there are symptoms that somebody experiences or things that signs that somebody that others may observe. And understanding how to manage and to treat those in the short time frame after the injury is very important, because the more that somebody can rest, the more that we can make sure that they're not doing risky activities and reduce the risk of a second injury, ultimately the better the outcome for the injury.
And what do you think needs to be done to help not only our kids but grown athletes who are dealing with mental issues, you know, following repeated head injuries? I know you said the research is sort of in its infancy, but I'm assuming there should be some sort of plan of action.
Yeah, we want to monitor kids after injury for a number of different types of symptoms. The brain is obviously a very complex organ, and so when we've got an injury to the brain, the symptoms may be physical in nature, like headaches. They may be emotional sequela. There may be cognitive effects in terms of concentrating and remembering, or there may be changes in the way somebody sleeps or their ability to fall asleep or stay asleep. So we want to have our radar up for any of these different types of effects from an injury, and certainly making sure that they're carefully monitored by trained medical professionals until they're fully recovered is very important.
Dr. Vaughn, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
That's Dr. Christopher Vaughn, again, a pediatric neuropsychologist at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. Check out the website, childrensnational.org/score.
Capture your need for sound.
For people who like to get outside and get their hands dirty in the garden, this is one of the magical times of the year for you. We are smack dab in planting season, and to give us an idea about what we should be doing and trying with our gardens this year is Tara Nolan, web editor for CanadianGardening.com. Tara, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Tara, you know, I guess tis the season for people to be heading off to their garden centers or nurseries. What cool or interesting things should they be on the lookout for in 2012?
Well, I think this past weekend was also a sort of an early indication of how excited people are in their garden, because everyone I passed was absolutely packed. There's lots of really nice annuals and perennials out there, and I've had the good fortune to see a few in person already myself, and I've got a few that I'm testing out in my own garden. There's a few interesting things. If you're looking to plant edibles, there's some really good, interesting new bushes. Hascap berries are hardy to zone 2, which means you can plant them pretty far north. And I think that's one of the bigger stories that we've been talking about at Canadian Gardening on the site, is that, you know, this is a great berry for gardeners who might not have the luxury of being able to plant some of the people that in, say, the southern parts of Canada can. So hascap berries are an interesting thing to look out for. And for annuals, it's funny because I always, every year I want to try to branch off from the petunia and try to find something else. But petunias always inevitably make their way into my garden because they keep coming out with pretty awesome ones. And one of the ones last year was the black petunia. This year there's some really interesting colors. One of them is called pink lemonade, and it's just this really interesting mix of like a pale yellow and pink, but really quite striking. And then if you do still like that black, dark color, there's the honeybee petunia, which is sort of like a deep almost black, but it's more of a purple and yellow. It's got a little bit of an accent color. And yeah, there's all sorts of really interesting plants out there to pick.
Something that sort of jumps to my mind, the fact that you talked about, you know, last year was the black and now this year it's this pink lemonade. Do gardeners always need to be on the thought process or the lookout for, you know, these different colors that might be coming out for the different years and just, you know, just to keep themselves not always locked into maybe solid colors or something that they always go back to?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, we were kind of looking at all the different plant trends coming up back in the winter when, you know, there's not really much else to do because we can't get out in our gardens. And Pantone, which is sort of the world's digital color, you know, expert, they declared Tangerine Tango back in the winter to be the color of the year. So you might see a lot of orange shades at the nursery this season because it's sort of infiltrated everything from fashion to gardening to home decor. So orange is definitely a color to keep an eye out for as well.
Now, when you are in the nursery, how do you read a plant tag? Because there seems to be a lot of information going on. And I think for newbies and maybe even, you know, people that are just a year or two in, it still might be confusing for them.
For sure. And you know what, even sometimes I plant things in spaces that they might not have been destined for. But, you know, I think you just have to definitely make sure that you're getting the light requirements. You know, something like a tomato needs a lot of sunlight in a day. So you want to make sure that it gets, you know, the sunniest patch of your garden. And then, you know, if you have some really shady areas, just keep an eye out on the plant tag for the little dark circle that shows that it doesn't have to be in a full sun spot, but it will survive, you know, under, the tree or any of your bushes or whatever that might cast shade on parts of your garden.
Now, are there ways to pick properly the seeds and whatever else that you need from the nurseries? Because I guess you just can't go in there willy-nilly.
Well, there's definitely a few tips that you can sort of take with you. I think one thing that people always get a little bit sidetracked by is picking the plant with the most blooms. But, you know, we've got an article online about things not to do at the nursery. And we always say, you know, would you rather your plant bloom at the nursery or do you want it to plant in your garden? Or to bloom in your garden, sorry. So I think that's one of the biggest tips I can give is that you can pick a plant with a lot of buds. And that way, when you get it home, that's when it's going to be in its full glory. And, you know, and it's not just, you know, you're not going to lose all the blooms the minute you get it home. Another thing is also just to check the roots and make sure that, you know, the roots aren't starting to come at the bottom and the plant isn't root bound in the pot. You want to get a really healthy plant and make sure, you know, there aren't any spots on the leaves or any sort of discoloration. And, you know, you want to make sure that you're getting the best plant to put in your garden so it's got a really good chance of surviving the season for you.
Hanging out on the show with us this week is Tara Nolan of CanadianGardening.com. You can also follow her on their Twitter account, at CDN Gardening. Something that popped into my mind as you were talking a few moments ago, Tara, is the fact that, you know, there are different regions, obviously, across our country here in Canada, obviously the same, you know, sort of deal of whether you're in the States or across the world. If you are or have moved and are used to, you know, a climate, let's say you, for some reason, are from Ontario, but for some reason you are moving now down to Louisiana. Is it important that you sort of figure out your new lay of the land because what you were doing in Ontario is not what's going to happen in Louisiana?
Well, you'll definitely have more options probably in Louisiana because things that would be considered perennial here would be an annual and grow all year round likely in Louisiana. So, you know, you can definitely take a walk around the neighborhood and see what thrives there, but also check what your zone is because you'll be able to plant a lot, like you'll have a lot more options basically of what you can plant down there. And things that we might consider a tropical house plant might thrive all year round down south.
And do you find a lot of difference between what we do over here in North America as opposed to what goes on maybe in Europe?
I think there's a lot of similarities. But I mean, Europe, the bulbs, I think there you see far more of a bulb display when you're over there. I've been to the Keukenhof in Holland, and actually there's a huge expo going on right now that lasts until mid-October. It's in the south of Holland, and it's called Floriade. And it's a huge... It's actually a great opportunity. It's a huge horticultural fair where you can see all the different gardening trends from around the world and what they do in their gardens. So, you know, it's really interesting to see how some flowers, you know, are more predominant or, you know, there's a lot more tropical plants in places that are further south where there's an emphasis on the flower arranging with those plants where, you know, they wouldn't be available to us all year round.
Now, getting back to particular things over here, what are hot plants?
Hot plants. So you want to know what the trends are as far as what to choose?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, I've never even heard of hot plants before. It sounds like some sort of fashion statement.
Well, it's basically the ones that I think the nurseries bring out each year. You kind of tend to see, you know, some of the bigger, you start to see patterns in what's brought out. Last year, I think one of the hot plants was the salad bowl gardens, where you found these readily planted bowls full of different lovely greens. This year, I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of different colors. I think, you know, you can just be mesmerized, and it's going to be really hard for you to choose which colors you want. And just a lot of really interesting, you know, I think a lot of breeders are really trying to think outside the box and bring some really interesting plants. One of the ones I previewed from President's Choice, which has the Loblaw garden centers all across the country, it was called the Lanai Verbena Twister Pink. And this would make a really interesting border, or add it to a container garden. And it was just a really interesting little bunch of blooms, because the inside is hollow, but then it's got this sort of, it's almost like a clock, where you've got all these little white and hot pink blooms all around the outside. So that's really neat. And then, as I mentioned, with the different types of petunias, you know, you can really run the gamut of the rainbow in your garden and choose different petunias that, you know, would suit any area and any color scheme. Another really interesting, there's some New Guinea impatiens that are just beautiful. They have the much bigger blooms than the standard little tiny impatiens that you see. Even begonias have some gorgeous colors out there. I would say the sunset begonia is one of my favorites. It's this really lovely peach color, almost, well, I guess the color of a sunset. And, you know, that's something that I've grabbed a basket to put in my yard, because I think it's really, really pretty.
I wanted to ask you as well, is there any trend that you are noticing this year? Because I know you are, you know, constantly up to date with what's going on, you know, not only in Canada, but I'm sure in the States and elsewhere. Are there any trends that we should be aware of with regards to, I don't know, strains of bugs this year that might be more prevalent, or pesky weeds that are, you know, something that is, you know, high octane this summer?
Well, I think with the mild winter we've had, particularly here in southern Ontario, you know, one of the things that they've said is that, you know, the mosquitoes and a lot of bugs are going to be worse this year, because they didn't have the chance to die off with a frosty, freezing, cold winter. So, you know, you might see a few more beasties in your garden this year, but, you know, it's definitely something that you'll just sort of have to deal with on a case-by-case basis. But as far as, you know, swarms of a certain kind of insect, you know, making their way to your garden, that I'm not necessarily aware of. But I have actually noticed that I have a lot of butterflies this year, so that's actually a really good sign, and as well as bees, because, you know, we hear a lot about how the bee populations are declining, so it's really nice to see the good bugs in your garden as well.
Perfect. And is there any final tips that you would have, again, as people launch out for their big planting season coming up?
Well, definitely take a bit of a plan to the garden center. I always find that I'm so overwhelmed when I get there, because you just want to buy everything, but then sometimes you come away with nothing because you're so overwhelmed with the choice now. There's just so much available. So I would definitely try to decide, you know, what areas of the garden, or maybe section it off. What area of the garden am I going to plant in this particular weekend? And what colors do I want? Do I want perennials that are going to come back every year? Do I want to fill them in with some really nice, colorful annuals and experiment? And then next year I'll, you know, figure out a different color scheme. So I think that's definitely one of the biggest tips. And also just to make sure that, you know, you are checking the plant over and making sure it's healthy. There's certain things you don't want to skimp on, like trees. You want to make sure that you spend, you know, good money on a tree so that it's healthy and that it, you know, it will stand the test of time in your garden. And also keep your receipts, because a lot of garden centers actually offer refunds. So if a plant doesn't work out, if you keep it, sometimes they'll cover it for up to a year, you can actually take it back and have it replaced with a new one.
Fantastic. Tara, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Tara Nolan again, web editor for CanadianGardening.com. You can also find her on Twitter at CDN Gardening.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Well, that pretty much does it for the show this week. Thank you so much for listening. I really enjoyed my conversations with my three guests, and I hope you did too. A big shout out to Mike Scotty, Dr. Christopher Vaughn, as well as Tara Nolan. Now, next week on the show, we are going to be jam-packed as well, including my chat with Dr. Ken Mengus about the very serious practice known as hazing. This behavior goes on around the world, on sports teams, on college campuses, not to mention university campuses, and even in the workplace. Dr. Mengus has some great advice about how to handle hazing and what actually is the root cause of it. He also talks about what needs to be done to curb the behavior and educate people that this is a very dangerous activity to be involved in. So don't forget to check it out on the show next week, KellyAlexanderShow.com. Now, like I like to do, leave you with an inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Rashika Janes. In the race of life, don't waste your energy and time trying to compare with others. Sometimes you are ahead, sometimes behind. The race is long, and in the end, it's only with yourself. I also want to mention that we have a brand new Twitter account for the show. Lots of information being posted there, and we would love for you to follow us on Twitter. And the Twitter handle is @KAlexanderShow. We look forward to seeing you there, also on our Facebook page, The Kelly Alexander Show. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.